Morning. Today's daf in Baba Kama is Ayin Beis. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is on the Zechon Ishmael Klibik, Arvela Bashmuel. We begin today in Ayin Alpha Amud Beis. We start at the two dots, about halfway down on the Amud. Ganav Mashal Aviv V'tavach Amachar. So the son steals from his father, and then he shechs, or he sells the animal. As we have started the seventh parak, more than started. My first day back on. As we continue in the seventh parak of Baba Kama, so we are discussing the halachas of Ganeva Gzela, stealing. And this is where the Masechta made a turn in terms of topic. Parakim 1 through 6 dealt with Nezikin, damages. And now as we already began well into the seventh parak of the Masechta, we're talking now about the Yisurim of Gneva, of theft. The Torah imposes a fine upon somebody if somebody steals and then is caught with the stolen goods, does not admit that he stole it, but caught with the stolen goods, so then he has to pay kefir, he has to pay not only the principal value of that which he took, but he also has to make full restitution one more time. That's a kenas, that's a punitive fine imposed by the Torah, that he has to add on a kenas as well, a kefir. What if after having stolen the item, he then either shechs the item, or he sells the item? So then the Torah makes another kenas, another punitive fine, in which he has to pay either four or five times the amount that which he stole. Why four or five? Because it depends on whether he steals a ox or a sheep. This extra fine is only going to be imposed in the case of an ox and a sheep. It's not going to be imposed in any other scenario. The Gemara already earlier established that as well. What we're going to be discussing over the course of this Mishnah and the next Mishnah are going to be various cases in which the fine is going to be imposed and the fine is not going to be imposed. So basically what the Mishnah is doing is giving us the classic contrast of here are going to be cases where there's going to be a knas, and these are going to be cases where there's not going to be a knas. So one of the cases mentioned in the Mishnah is, unfortunately, family issues. The son is stealing from the father. Son steals from the father, shechs the animal, and so the Mishnah says, under such circumstances, as long as he stole it before the father died, so then he's going to be chayv d'al v'hei, he's going to have to pay four or five times the amount. This takes us back to the Mishnah that we saw on Ayin Amud Aleph. Okay, so the Gemara takes our Mishnah and is going to turn it into a slightly different discussion, but we're going to then bring it back to our Mishnah. Baminei, Rabba Mi Rav Nachman, the following question was proposed from Rabba to Rav Nachman as follows. Ganav Shor Shol Shnei Shutfim V'Tavchom. So let's say a person shechs an animal, steals an animal, I should say, from two partners. So over here, it's not a classic scenario in which one person owns the item, but partnership. And each person now has 50% share in the animal that was stolen. And what he does then is he shechs it. He shechs the animal. So here we are now in a classic situation where stolen item, and then compounded his sin by having shechted the item that which he stole. However, here the complication begins. V'hodu le'echad mehem. But what he does is that he turns to one of the partners and he makes an admission. He says, "Hi, how are you? Good morning. I stole your cow and I shechted the animal." As we've known, we've seen time and again throughout our Masechta, mod b'knas pater. Once he makes an admission, so that is going to waive him from the kenas. He obviously still has to make full restitution of that which he stole, but he's not going to have to pay the kefil, he's not going to pay the dal vehei. Here the complication lies in the fact that there were two owners to the animal, each one only represented 50% share, and he only made an admission to one of the two. So clearly to that one person that he made an admission to, he's not going to have to pay kefil, he's not going to pay dal vehei, or at least his 50% share in that. What about the other partner? The other partner he didn't admit to, he didn't make it a hodah. So, is he going to be on the hook for kefil and dal vehei to the second partner? This is a question. Mao. Chamisha bakar amar rachmana velo chamisha chatzai bakar. When the Torah says that you have to pay four, is the Torah saying that you're only going to pay four and you do not prorate? If there's ever going to be a scenario, like this one right here, if there's ever going to be a scenario in which you're not paying the full four or five times punitive damages, like in this particular case where you admitted to one of the partners, so to him you're not going to be paying four or five times the amount, and you're only going to be paying half to the other partner. Well, maybe then the Torah does not impose the punitive fine of dal v'hei. Oh, Dilma, chamisha baka, amar rachmana v'afilu chamisha chatzai baka. Or no, the Torah is just simply giving us a cap. The Torah is just simply saying you're going to pay four or five times that amount. Doesn't mean that you're going to pay all of it. In this scenario, you're going to be paying half of it. But the Torah does not mean four or five or nothing. Torah means four or five or any portion thereof. So, The first answer of Nachman is it's five or nothing. Meaning, either you're going to be in a position where you're going to be paying all four or all five times the amount of the animal, or you pay nothing. And since in this particular case he made an admission to one of the partners, and that clears him from liability to half of the obligation, he therefore half the fine, therefore he's not going to be paying the other half as well. This is Rav Nachman's response. Eitzvei, the Gemara challenges based on our Mishnah, Ganav Mishal Aviv, son stole from his father, v'tavachu machar. And then afterwards he shechted the animal, v'achar kach meis aviv. And then after having shechted the animal, then and only then his father dies. Misham tashlum me'abra v'chamisha. What did our Mishnah teach us? Our Mishnah taught us he has to pay four or five times the amount of that which he stole and shechted. Let's consider. Now, obviously, him being one of the sons, that means that he's part of the estate. That means that when his father dies, now he shechted the animal after the father died. But when the father dies, so now he's going to be paying the estate. Well, guess what? He's one of the members of the estate. So that means, obviously, that what he's going to be doing for his portion of the estate is taking the money out of his right pocket and moving it directly into his left pocket. Meaning, he's not going to be paying the full four or five times the amount. He's going to be paying that minus his portion. Our Mishnah seems to be pretty clear that despite the fact that you're not paying the full four or five times the amount, you're still going to have to pay. Okay, and this obviously poses a difficulty to Rav Nachman. So the Gemara says it's comparable. Now the comparison over here is not perfect, but it's comparable in that when we go back to our original case where there were two partners, and he admitted to one of the two partners, and you're mod biknas and you're patur, so therefore you're going to be exempt from paying the first of the two partners. Similarly over here, when the father dies, and now the estate is collecting, and he's one of the members of the estate, so it's like, again, strong word, strong emphasis on the word like, it's like the case of admitting to one of the partners. So the Gemara says, but still, the general point that we just learned in our Mishnah is despite the fact that he's not paying the full four or five, he's prorating it, and he's only paying a fraction of it, still the Mishnah says he pays a fraction of it. So it sounds like Rav Nachman's got somewhat of an issue. How would he learn our Mishnah? Amarlei. So Rav Nachman's response, so the Gemara says, okay, well, Rav Nachman, in response to the case of our Mishnah, would suggest that our Mishnah is talking about a scenario in which Hamad the Bedin, they went to court already, meaning the father took his son to court, the court ruled, you owe the money, so now the son owes the full amount. Granted that between the court's ruling and him actually paying, his father dies, but at least now, according to Rav Nachman, you understand the Mishnah, because the court made a ruling that you owe the full amount. Okay, so the Gemara says, "Ava lo ama v'din ma'in amasham tashum abra v'chamisha." So that's interesting. So now, just imagine. Let's say, same case, son stole from the father, but let's say they didn't go to court, and they didn't have amad v'din. So now it would come out then, that when the father dies, before having been taken to court, so now the father dies, so now it's the estate that's suing him. He's one of the members of the estate, and you're telling me now that because he's not paying the full four or five times the amount, he's not paying any of it. Interesting. So now what comes out is that really we can make a very fine distinction in the Mishnah between a scenario in which, same exact case, steals from the father and shechts the animal, and then the father dies, and the only detail we need to switch is going to be whether or not there was Hamad Bedin or there wasn't Hamad Bedin. And you know the Gemara does this time and again. If we can make such a fine distinction, why did the Mishnah make such a general distinction of him shechting the animal before the father died versus him shechting the animal after the father died? What we could do is deal with the same exact scenario and just make that one very small switch of whether or not there was Hamad Bedin or there wasn't Hamad Bedin. And the Gemara asks exactly this question. When we get to the next Mishnah, we're going to learn together that in a scenario in which he shechs the animal after his father dies, so then he's not going to be obligated to pay dal v'hei. So niflag v'didei. Why don't we make a better distinction? The only time that he's going to be paying dal v'hei is only when there was hamada bedin. He shechted the animal. His father took him to court, and then the court ruled. However, if he shechted the animal, his father's still alive. His father simply didn't get a chance to take him to court, and then the father dies. He's not going to pay dal v'hei. Again, based on the fact that he's not paying the full dal v'hei, and again, Rav Nachman's making the argument, once you're not paying the full dal v'hei, you're not paying any of the dal v'hei. So Amalei Hachinami, so Rav Nachman says, yes, of course the Mishnah could have done that, but I did the Nasiv Reisha Ganav Mishal Aviv V'tach V'machar V'achakach Meitz Aviv Nasiv Seif Anami Ganav V'Mishal Aviv U'Meitz Aviv V'achakach Tavach V'machar Machar. And so Rav Nachman's response is, yes, you're right, the Mishnah could have done that, but you know the Mishnah loves symmetry. The Mishnah loves giving cases which are nearly identical and in sing-song basically comes out to be rhythmically the same. It's just now going to be a question of whether or not he shechts before the father dies or after the father dies. But truth be told, says Rav Nachman, is that the Mishnah could have made even a better distinction. We would call this somewhat of a dochik answer, a forced answer. In Rav Nachman, doesn't really deal with the basic question of why didn't the Mishnah make a better distinction, but just simply for purposes of symmetry, and it just simply sounds better, and it's easier to commit the Mishnah to memory when the Mishnah is encoded in this way. Okay, and here's where the story gets interesting. Ask Rav Nachman the same exact question the next morning. And the next morning, Rav Nachman gave a different response. Rav Nachman wakes up the next morning and says, you know what? I feel that the dal v'hei, the 4 or 5 time penalty that a person has to pay, is even in a case where he doesn't have to pay the full penalty, even in a case where he pays even part of the penalty, you're still going to have to pay dal v'hei. Meaning, Rav Nachman realized the next morning, after thinking about the Mishnah, you know what, he's right. In the case of the Mishnah, if the son stole from the father, the Mishnah says that if the, and he shechts it, and then the father dies, and then they go to court, the Mishnah says he has to pay dal v'hei. And again, let's consider, of the estate that he has to pay, he's one of the members of the estate. He's not paying the full dal v'hei. So you know what, it really does sound that you're going to be paying dal v'hei even if you're not paying the full dal v'hei. And going back to our original question, when a person steals from two partners and shechs the animal and then admits to one of the partners, so then even though he's not paying to one of the partners dal v'hei, he'll pay to the other partner the prorated dal v'hei. Okay, so basically Rav Nachman woke up the next morning and he gave a different answer. And v'hai delo amrle b'orta, so the night prior. So why didn't he say that? Meaning, what? Why did he change his tune? The Gemara gives a fascinating answer. Top of Ayin Beis Amar Alf Delo Achli Bisra Detur, because he didn't eat meat. Yeah. Okay, after almost a week now of having seeing what life is like a vegetarian, so I think I understand a little bit. So he didn't eat meat. If you take a look at Rashi over here, Rashi writes on the top of Ayin Beis Amar Alf Delo Achli Bisra Detur Lo Digdakti Tamishol Davar. So Rashi understands the Gemara over here euphemistically, meaning I didn't eat meat is a euphemism for I didn't really check into it. Meaning, I didn't think about it properly. I didn't give it the proper consideration that was necessary. And Vassar over here is just simply a euphemism for I didn't do my due diligence. If you take a look at Tosfos over here on the very top, Delo Achle Basa Datura, Tosfos says Shari B'Tanisaya. Tosfos takes the Gemara and Rav Nachman's statement super literally. It means yesterday he was fasting for whatever reason. The Gemara doesn't give an explanation, but for whatever reason he was fasting. And as we know, one's coming up. So we know that by the end of the fast, you are clouded. You can't concentrate, you can't focus, and it's hard. And so Tosfos understands Rav Nachman's response quite literally that he didn't eat, he wasn't able to concentrate, and that's why yesterday he gave one answer, but this morning, after having his coffee, so he gave a different answer. Okay. Ve'ala maishna reisha maishna seifa. So the Gemara says, so now it comes out as follows. That we have just learned according to Rav Nachman in his morning response, in his clarified response, that a person is going to be paying dal v'hei, even a scenario where he's not paying the full dal v'hei. Like the case of the two partners, like the case where the son is, the estate now is, has a claim against the son, and the son is now one of the members of the estate, so he'll be paying every other member of the estate. Obviously, he's not paying himself, but still, in both cases, we have now come out that, according to Rav Nachman, you're going to be paying dal v'hei, even though you're not paying the full dal v'hei. That's Rav Nachman's final answer. So the Gemara says, if that's true, so when, then what's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? Take a look at the second Rashi in the Amud. Came to Reisha, afilo Hamad Bedin, because now that we've established that, our Mishnah is talking about a case where there was no Hamad Bedin. He stole from the father, he shechted from the father, and then the father died. And at that point in time, they wasn't taken to court yet. The Kamarachmana de Chamisha Bakar, afilo Chamisha Chatzai Bakar. And we've established that you're paying, and not only are you paying, but you're going to be paying your brothers. You're going to be paying the estate, even though you yourself are not paying yourself. And what happens, that's the Reisha. What are we going to be learning in the upcoming Mishnah, which we're going to see in the very short future? Seifa kish, I'm continuing in Rashi. Seifa kishemetzav v'achar kach tavachumacha. Lama lo yishal macha v'tzchal kam. So now let's think about it. So now, after dad has died, so now what? So the Mishnah, the next Mishnah is going to be talking about a case in which after dad died, so now he shechted the animal. And he shechted the animal, and he doesn't pay dal vehe. Why not? Why shouldn't he be dal being paid? Why shouldn't he pay dal vehe? Meaning, in the upcoming Mishnah, okay, dad is dead, but now this is the estate's animal. He just shechted the estate's animal. Granted, he's a part owner in it, but he's only that. He's only a part owner in it. There still is the other members of the estate who are also owners in the animal, and he just stole and shechted the estate's animal. So then what is the difference between our Mishnah and the upcoming Mishnah when once we've established that you don't have to pay full dal vehei? Even if you're paying a portion of dal vehei, you're still going to pay. So then what's the difference? It's really a strong question. And the Gemara's answer goes like this. Amar le reisha karina be'vetavcho kulo be'isura. Seifa lo karina be'vetavcho kulo be'isura. So the Gemara over here gives a fascinating answer in terms of when does the Torah impose this liability of dal vehei? You have to shech the animal kulo bi'isura, where the animal is 100% not your animal. In the first case, in our Mishnah's case, the father's still alive when he shechted the animal. The animal did not belong to him one bit, not an iota. Now, granted, he stands to inherit it, but until his father dies, it's not his. So when he shechts the animal, it's kulo bi'isura. He shechts the animal, and none of it belonged to him. As opposed to the upcoming Mishnah, where he shechted the animal after dad died. Well, since dad has died, so now a part of the animal belongs to him. Now, obviously, he shouldn't have shechted the animal. He should have given it back to the estate. But since part of the animal belonged to him, it's not kulo bi'isura, and that's why in the upcoming Mishnah, he's not going to be charged with a dal vehei. Obviously, he's still going to have to make full restitution to the estate, but he's not going to be paying dal vehei. It's not kulo bi'isura. We are, even though the Mishnah is dot dot dot, meaning, I'm sorry, the heading of the Gemara right now is dot dot dot. The Gemara is going to be focusing on a case a little bit later on in the Mishnah. Okay. If you look back in the Mishnah, an Ayin Amud Aleph, so the Mishnah, one of the cases the Mishnah dealt with was shechting an animal. A person who shechts an animal in the Azara. Okay. Let's just get some of the basics down. Taking a carbon shechting outside the base of Mikdash is specifically, candidly mentioned in the Torah. Torah in Parshat Sachrimo says, you cannot shech an animal, a carbon, outside the base of Mikdash. This is what we refer to in the Gemara as Shchut Ichutz. Shechting a carbon outside the base of Mikdash. This is a very serious offense. This is one of the 34 lavim in the Torah, where it comes with it in Issur Karis. You are, by Karis prohibition, prohibited to take a carbon and shecht it outside the base of Mikdash. What if you take a non-carbon animal and shecht it in the base of Mikdash? Torah does not mention it specifically, whether or not it's prohibited. There is a range of opinions. We saw this back in Kedushin. There is a range of opinion in terms of level of prohibition it is. According to some, it's an issur d'oraisa. According to others, it's an issur d'rabbanan. Okay, but it's asur. That for sure. So taking chulin and shechting it in the azara could be that just simply taking the chulin into the azara, but certainly taking chulin and shechting the azara is going to be an issur. If you were to do that, the resulting animal would be prohibited. Our Mishnah is teaching us that if this ganav were to take the animal that he stole and shecht it in the azara, he's still going to be liable for the dal vehei. Okay. Now, one other point to consider before we go on in the Gemara, and that's the following. There's a classic debate that takes place time and again throughout Shas, and that is the issue of Shechita, Eino Shechita L'Shabesov, or Yesh L'Shechita Mitchila V'Yatsov. And basically, it goes like this. The process of shechting is taking a knife, running it across the front of the neck of the animal, and slicing the first two pipes, the trachea and the esophagus. And for an animal, you have to go through the majority of both the trachea and the esophagus. Then and only then is it going to be a good shechita. Now, there is one opinion which is ein l'shechita l'besof. Obviously, to get to the point of 51% of both pipes, you obviously have to go through 50%. It's kind of a no-brainer, right? The knife can only get through 51% if it got for the first 50. However, if you take the position of ein l'shechita ela besof, that shechita is only regarded at the very end of the shechita process, that means that when you're cutting through half of the pipe of the esophagus and half the pipe of the trachea, so that's kind of like a heksher. It's kind of like, yeah, I got to get to that in order to get to 51. But really, in terms of the significant moment, the part that's labeled as "quote unquote" shechita, eino ela ela besof, that only comes at the end. Everything prior to that, obviously, is a necessary component, but that's not labeled shechita. That's one opinion. The other opinion that the Gemara records is yesh shechita mitzchila v'ad sof. Shechita goes from the beginning to the end, meaning from the very first incision until you get to the point of 51% of each pipe. That's considered shechita. Now, the Gemara over here doesn't discuss it, but Rashi over here mentions it. I'll mention it as well. Why is that significant? Either way, you're going to have to cut 51%. What difference does it make? So Rashi over here points out, well, we know that when a kohen shechts an animal and has a machshava psula, he has a thought that renders the animal disqualified, so then the carbon's not going to be any good. When does a kohen need to have machshava psula? During shechita. Now, when we say during shechita, what does that mean? So here, exactly is that how it's going to play out. So if you only hold yesh l'shechita eino l'shechita ela besof, so that means that the kohen has to have the machshava not at the beginning of the incision, but at the point of 51, and only at the point of 51. If you hold yesh l'shechita mitchila v'yatsof, so that means from the beginning of the incision until the point of 51, any time during that point in time, the kohen has a machshava of chutzlus mano, chutzlum komo, so then the animal is going to be disqualified through the disqualification of pigle. Okay, so that's how generally it plays out. The Gemara over here doesn't discuss that detail. The Gemara over here discusses the following. Amar le Rav Chavivi mechuzana le Rav Ashi. Shema minayin l'shechita l'besof. When you take a look at our Mishnah and you analyze the Mishnah, it seems like the only way to understand the Mishnah is that shechita only comes at the end. Meaning the status of shechita only comes at the very end. How do you arrive at that conclusion after having learned our Mishnah? Because consider, if you think shechita begins at the first incision and continues all the way to the 51% mark, so then consider, we have taken an animal that is not kodesh, it's a chulin animal, and I shechted it, I'm going to use the words very carefully, and I shechted it in the azara. The moment I shecht an animal in the azara, so that's it. That is chulin sheneshchetu ba'azara, and at that point in time now, it becomes prohibited. Remember, in order for a ganav to be chayav dal v'hei, he has to be shechting the owner's animal. But if chulin sheba'azara kicks in at the first point of the incision, it's no longer the owner's animal, and then he's not going to be subject to the dal v'hei payment. So therefore, idach lo demarika tavach, that means then that the rest of the animal that he shechted is not the owner's animal. It therefore must be that the only time it's regarded shechita from a status standpoint is only when you get to the end of the shechita. Where now, the ganav did effectively shecht the owner's animal, and then when he got to the end of the shechita, he also rendered the animal disqualified through the problem of chulin sheneshchetu ba'azara. This is the argument, it seems to be an excellent argument, that the eino shechita ela besof. But There are certain times in the Gemara where the Gemara does not want to resolve the issue. It's not because it doesn't want to resolve the issue. It just the Gemara knows that this is a debated issue, and right, it's mekayim l'olam v'ayed. It's just one of those issues where we know it's unresolved. So basically, the Gemara is it's always going to do this. It's always going to defend both opinions, even in what seemingly is a very clear tip to the side of Ein L'Shechita Ela B'Sof. So the Gemara now is going to defend. Amalei Rav Huna Brei D'Rava Ki Kamechayev Al Porta. So the Gemara says, so maybe answer number one of the Gemara is, okay, even though you're only, the Shechita may not come at the end, but liability for the Ganav and Dal V'Hei comes at the very first incision. That is one suggestion of the Gemara. Amalei Rav Ashi Lo Titche Lo Titche. So Rav Ashi says, please, let's not do that. Let's not give such a forced answer. Because, utvacho, kulo be'ina. When you read the Torah and you read the Pasuk in Mishpatim that talks about when a person is going to be liable for Dal V'Hei, the Torah says, either he sells it or he shechs it. Now, shechita means in totality, or 51%. But in other words, there has to be a full shechita. So don't tell me that the Dal V'Hei penalty comes about the moment he takes the knife and he makes that first incision into the neck of the animal. It's simply not true. V'leka, and we don't have that over here. Elakasha, so the Gemara says, okay, so how would you explain our Mishnah within the opinion of Yesh Hashchita Mitzchol V'Yatzof? Amalei Hachem Rav Gamda Mishmei Derava Kegon Sheshacha Mitzah Simani B'chutz V'Gamran Bifnim. So it's an Ukimta. It is certainly an unusual scenario in the Mishnah, but maybe the Mishnah would be talking about where the Ganav started shechting the animal right outside of the Azara, and then while continuing to shech the animal, can't pause in the middle, one of the five psulim of Shechita Shehiya, so you're not allowed to pause in the middle, but while continuing to shech the animal, as he gets now to the tail end of the Shechita, to the 51%, he then brings it into the Azara, so now you have Chulin Sheneshkutu Ba'Azara, and he also shechted the owner's animal. Okay, so that's how you can understand the case in the Mishnah and still maintain the position of yeshna shechita mitzchilo v'yatzof. Yeah.
Why is it that after if the animal is prohibited, it's not the owner's animal? Why is that?
Once the prohibition creates an isra hana. Generally speaking, we say that once something's isra hana, it becomes ownerless. Chametz bePesach is just a good example, right? Chametz bePesach. So now it happens to be that you're going to be liable for having chametz on Pesach. But if you remember the Gemara says it's one of those unusual cases where it's not yours and the Torah makes it yours. But generally speaking, once something's asur b'hana, that's it. It has zero value, and default it becomes ownerless item. So once it's chulin ba'azara, it's now asur b'hana, and therefore becomes an ownerless item. So the Igadamasin La'aha. Now we're going to do the same thing. We're going to have this basically the same discussion, but instead of piggybacking off of our Mishnah, we're just going to first learn the machlokas straight out, and then have the discussion. But it's going to be basically the same. I'll go quickly. I'm Rabbi Shimon Mishum de Rabbi Levi Saba Ein L'Shechita Ela B'Sof. So the Gemara quotes in the name of Rabbi Levi Saba, the elderly Rabbi Levi, the Shechita is only at the end. Rav Yochanan Amar Yesh Lan Shechita Mitzchil V'Yatzof, and Rav Yochanan takes the position that Shechita goes from beginning to end. So Amalei Rav Chavivi Mechuzen L'Rav Ashi Lemekas of Rav Yochanan Chulin Shenishchutu Ba'Azar Lav Daraisa Hu. So now, are you telling me that according to Rav Yochanan, Chulin that Shechta in the Azara is not an Isser Daraisa? Remember, and back before we started the Gemara, I mentioned the Torah does not mention specifically that shechting a non-carbon in the Azara is prohibited. And again, there are varying degrees of how prohibited is it? Is it an Issa D'Oraisa or is it an Issa D'Rabbanan? If you say it's an Issa D'Oraisa, you also have to find the source in the Torah that teaches us it's an Issa D'Oraisa. Okay. The Gemara in Kedushin, we did this back. Rashi reminds me, Daf Nun Ches. Not sure if I could have done that without Rashi, but we did this back in Kedushin in terms of the degree of prohibition and what the possible source is. But either way, are you telling me that according to Rav Yochanan, Chulin Ba'Azara is not an Issa D'Oraisa? The Isak D'Oraisa. So because if you maintain that Chulin Ba'Azara is an Issa D'Oraisa, and if Rav Yochanan would maintain that, Mechisha Chalei Porta Asra, idach lav demari katavach. And then we run into the problem. Now this should sound like a repetition of what we said earlier. It is. It's just that now we just here we're presenting the two sides. If you hold that according to Rav Yochanan, shechitas from the beginning to the end, and if you hold that according to Rav Yochanan, shecht min chulin liazar is an issa daraisa, so now we have arrived at the impasse. The impasse is that the moment I take the knife and make the beginning of the incision, that's the beginning of shechita, meaning the status of shechita. And now because it's chulin liazar, it now becomes prohibited. What now becomes prohibited, it no longer belongs to the owner. Now that it no longer belongs to the owner, the ganav did not shech the owner's animal, and therefore he shouldn't be liable for the dal v'hei. And meanwhile, in our Mishnah taught us he is liable for the dal v'hei.
But he made the owner disown by his act of shechita.
I understand that, but you're right. But the only time the Torah imposes dal v'hei is only for shechting, and specifically for shechting the owner's animal. The isak adacha da araisa michishach le port asra idach lav demar katavach. I'm sorry, we read that. So amar le rav acha berei de ravaki kamechayv nami au porta. So the Gemara says, okay, so again, we're going to go through the same dialogue. So the Gemara says, well, maybe the Torah only imposes dal v'hei for making that very first incision. But then the Gemara immediately rejects that. Amar le rav ashi lo titchei. Don't give such a forced answer. V'tavcho, the Torah says, yeah, the ganav has to shecht it. Kula be'inan v'leka, he's got to shecht all of it. He didn't do that yet. Elakasha, so the Gemara says, okay, we're seemingly stuck. Amalei hachi, amarav gamda, mishmei derava ki mechayev, ki gom sheshecha mixas imanim b'chutzve, gamram bifnim. So the Gemara says, okay, he shechted some of the animal. Most of the animal, let's say 50%. 50% of the animal was shechted outside the Azara, so it still belongs to the owner. And then as he's approaching now, 0.51 of the shechita, 51% of the two pipes, so now he enters into the Azara, he shechts those two, and so that is the scenario in which the ganav would be both shechting chulin the Azara and be liable for the dal v'hei because he shechted the owner's animal. Okay, adkan. We are in the next Mishnah, we're 9 Beis Amud Beis, and we are beginning now the next Mishnah, Ganav Al Pi Shnayim, V'tavach Umachar Al Piyam. Let's say the Ganav Shechted on the report of two witnesses, meaning he did not make a confession, an admission that he shechted the animal. Witnesses saw and testified that he did so. And Tavach Umachar Al Piyam, the same witnesses now continue to watch, observe, as the ganav now not only stole the animal, but compounded his sin by either shechting or selling the animal. Okay, so far so good. We have a classic scenario where the ganav is going to be chayv kefal and al v'hei. Small problem over here, witnesses were lying. And furthermore, not only were the witnesses lying, but edim zomimim. They turned out to be conspiring witnesses, which, as we know, in the beginning of Masechta Makos, is talking about a very specific scenario in which a second pair of witnesses come into the court and say, Imanu Hayisim Makom Ploni. These first set of witnesses are not telling the truth, and we know they're not telling the truth because they were with us at the time. There is no way they could have testified simply because they were with us at the time where they claimed that both of the events happened. We know the Torah says by Edim Zomim and Parsha Shoftim, Vasisim Lo Kasher Zomam Lasos Lachiv. You do to the witnesses what they conspired to do to the defendant. Here, the defendant was now on the hook to make full restitution and Dal V'hei, and now these witnesses, who turned out to be conspiring witnesses, are going to get boomeranged that sentence that they wanted to fall on the defendant. They, the witnesses, now have to pay dal v'hei. Okay. Classic scenario of Edom Zomim. So, Misham and Venimsu Zomimim, Misham and Hakol. These witnesses are now going to have to pay everything. Meaning, the dal v'hei that they conspired for this defendant to pay. Okay, and now, basically, what the Mishnah is going to do in these next cases is try to break it down. Let's say, ganav al pi shnayim v'tavach umachar al pi shnayim acherim. Let's say the first pair of witnesses saw the theft. The second pair of witnesses saw the shechita. So now, elu ve'elu nimtzu zomim. Now, in this case, both pairs of witnesses were caught as conspiring witnesses, as edim zomimim. Harishonim Misham and Tashum et Kefel. So now the first set of witnesses, so they are, they what kind of financial liability were they looking to get out of the defendant? Kefal. I mean, because they just testified about the theft. So, based on their testimony, the defendant would have had to pay kefal. Once they're proven to be Edom Zomimim, so kefal bounces on them, and they now have to pay kefal. What about the second set of witnesses? Interesting. The second set of witnesses, well, the first set of witnesses are responsible for kefal. So what are the second set of witnesses going to be responsible for? The difference between kefal and dal vehei, meaning whatever that spread was between kefal and dal vehei. Now, I say whatever because it's either dollar or it's a. So let's just assume, and you'll see this is what the mission is going to do. Let's assume it's five times. So five times minus two times. So the second set of witnesses are going to be on the hook for three times the amount of the animal. So,
Okay. But the thing is,
you have
that discussion about the value at the time was stolen. Which value did they go by?
Okay, that goes back to the earlier discussion in the parrot. But just in terms of how to
bring. Because the is
okay, right. That could complicate it. But that goes back to the beginning. But for our purposes right now, the Mishnah just wants to simply break down what if the first pair found Zomimim and the second pair found Zomimim. And you know what the Mishnah is going to do next? The Mishnah is now going to play around with whether one of the two are found Zomimim. Nimsu Achronim Zomimim. So now, let's say of the two sets of witnesses, the first set of witnesses are fine, seemingly telling the truth. We have nothing else to go by. So he stole. Fine. And now, because he was caught with the item that he stole, and witnesses testified about it, he has to pay kefal. Fine. What about the second set of witnesses who said that he shechted it, and turned out the second set of witnesses were conspiring? You see, the second set of witnesses weren't looking to have him pay five times the amount. He already was on the hook for two times. So the second set of witnesses were only interested, not interested, but, yeah, I guess you could say interested. The second set of witnesses were only interested in having him pay an additional three times the amount. So who misham tashlo mekefal, vehe misham tashlo megimel. So because the first set of witnesses were not proven false, so therefore the ganav himself has to pay kefal, and the second set of witnesses who were proven to be zomimim have to pay the differential between five times and two times, or three times the amount of the animal. Echem and achronim, I'm sorry. Who misham tashlo mekefal, vehe misham tashlo megimel. Echem and achronim zomimim. Let's say one of the second set of witnesses turned out to be Edom Zomimim. Basic rule by Edom Zomimim. We're going to see this in the beginning of Makos. In order to apply the rule of Asisim Lo Kasher Zomam La'asos Achiv, that the whatever the sentence was is going to get bounced back to the Edom Zomimim, is only when both witnesses are proven to be Edom Zomimim. If only one of the two witnesses are proven to be Edom Zomimim, we just simply take the testimony and we throw it out. But they are not given the rebound, the conspiring sentence that they look to impose on the defendant. Okay, it's just a simple rule. So the Gemara says, so Echem and Achronim Zomimim.
How could it be though? If two people come and say they are coming together, and someone is Zomimim, the other one is also Zomimim, because
no,
how
not,
could it be together?
Well, no, the second set of witnesses only point to one of the original witnesses and says, Imanu Ayisim. The other one, I don't know. It could be the second one telling the truth. I don't know. Okay, so Echem and Achronim Zomimim, Bala Edishniyah. Okay, so that means then that the Edishniyah now is just simply nullified. Okay, no consequence to the second set of witnesses, because again, the only time we talk consequences when both of them are proven to be Edom Zomimim. Echem and Harishonim Zomimim, but here now the Mishnah deals with the next scenario. Let's say one of the first set of witnesses turn out to be Edom Zomimim. So here now comes the domino effect. If the first set of witnesses turn out to be Edom Zomimim, so what does that mean now? It means now that we're throwing out the first set of witnesses. But again, they're not Edom Zomimim.
They're stolen
then. Right, they're not Edom Zomimim because you need both of them to have been Muzam. So they're not Edom Zomimim. But we nevertheless, we throw out the testimony because we're only left with one and one does not create testimony. So we throw it out. So now this person didn't steal. So if this person didn't steal, the person didn't shecht. Now it could be that he did shecht, but he didn't shecht the stolen animal. You only get imposed with the penalty of dal v'hei if you shecht the stolen animal. we have not established that the animal was shechted. So therefore the shechita is just nothing more than just shechita. So now a domino effect in which, in this scenario, but la kol ha'edush, shimi ein gneva, ein tvicha ve'ein mechira. Once there's no gneva, there's not going to be tvicha mechira, so everything falls away, and, okay, itmar. Let's begin. This is one of the most classic discussions. Third paragraph of Sanhedrin is where you're going to find this. You're going to find it right here on today's daf and tomorrow's daf. And that is the following. Eid Zomim. Let's say you have a witness who's discovered to be an Eid Zomim. And let's say he testified in the month of Nisan, and then the Eidim Zomimim come in the month of Iyar, a full month later. And over the course of that time, let's say this witness had a busy month, right? He's our traditional witness. He's been called into court throughout the month of Nisan. Now I know it's Pesach, so 7 days are going to be somewhat difficult to get into court, but there's not going to be court. Okay, but you understand. In other words, so he testified in the month of Nisan on a particular case, and then only a month later, the Edom Zomim, this is just simply how things work, the Edom Hamazimim come in a month later and say, on the first day of Nisan, when that guy testified, I don't know how in the world he testified, Imanu Hayisim B'mokum Ploni, he was with us at the time. Now,
has the verdict been carried out yet?
Well, that is a good question because okay, right, you're right. Okay, you and I now are thinking the same. Okay, I'm not sure about that point. Okay, now let's talk about intuitively before we go on in the Gemara. Intuitively, what I would have thought, and I'm assuming, I generally speak, I'm a reasonable thinker. Okay, you don't have to agree, but what I would have thought, and then you can either agree or disagree with me. But intuitively, I would have thought, even though the Edom HaMazimim coming in a month later, but they're coming in a month later, proving that he was lying, going all the way back to the first day of Nisan. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, he was lying. We only discovered it later, but okay, discovery took place later. He lied on the first day of Nisan. I would have said, he's a liar going back to the first day of Nisan. So if he's a liar going back to the first day of Nisan, so I think it's easy now to, meaning, we know for sure, well, let me make this point very clear. We know for sure that from the first day of Iyar and onward, meaning after the Edom HaZimim come in, we no longer have any credibility for these witnesses. They lie. That's true from the first day of Iyar, when discovery took place. But what, do we extend their status of being false witnesses all the way to the first day of Nisan? So again, intuitively, I'd say of course. Meaning, even though only discovery took place later, but they lied on the first day of Nisan. So, as a general rule of thumb, if you're lying on the first day of Nisan, and you did so in court, you probably lied on the second day of Nisan, and on the fourth day of Nisan, and on the 20th day of Nisan, well, that's already Pesach, and on the 23rd day of Nisan, and, okay, you understand. And we don't even have to be intuitive about it. Meaning, what makes you disqualified as a witness? Once you're proven to be a liar, so that's it. You no longer have credibility. Now, it happens to be that discovery took place later, but the fact is that he lied on the first day of Nisan. So I would have suggested that from an intuitive standpoint, his point of disqualification should be throughout the month of Nisan, even though we only learned that later on, and even though that means now that it's going to undo, perhaps, a lot of court cases. And that's going to be unfortunate, but that's what I would say intuitively. Here, the Gemara has a classic machlokas. Itmar, Eid Zomim, Abai Amar L'Mafreya Nifsal. So Abai says L'Mafreya, what I just described, his disqualification will not go back to the point of discovery, it will go all the way back to the point where he actually lied. That's Abai's position. Rav Amar Mikanu L'Abahu Nifsal. And Rav says no. His status of being a lying witness only goes from the point of discovering onward, but not retroactive to the time that they actually lied. Okay, Rav has got some explaining to do. So let's go. Abaye Amar L'Mafreya Nifsal Me'ushayt Da'asid Havalei Rasha V'Atorah Amra Al Tashes Rasha Aid. Abaye's position so easy to articulate. He was a Rasha from the time that he lied in court. Now we didn't learn about it till a month later. Okay, But he was a Russia from that point in time. So from that point in time going forward, obviously we only can say this retroactively, but from that point going forward, he was a Russia, and therefore all testimony that he gave from the first day in Nisan onward is going to be not acceptable.
But what if he had testified during like Adar, like before the first time that he was on?
He wasn't a Russia before. I understand that. No. A person has a chazakah of being a kosher person. I mean, granted, he lost it, but he has a chazakah. Rava Amar Mikanu Labau Nifsal, Eid Zomim Chidashu, Da Trevitre Ninu. My chaz is the Tzayis Lahani. Tzayis Lahani. Hilkach Ein Lecha Bo Ella Mishas Chidush Ve'elach. And Rava says like this. I'm telling you that, yes, I understand Abai's position, but let's consider. Adam Zomim is strange, and the Gemara says it here. The Gemara says in the beginning of Makos, Adam Zomim is strange. In that, you have two sets of witnesses who are saying the following happened. A second pair of witnesses come into the court and say, Imano Yisrael Mamakam Ploni. I don't know what he's talking about. He was with us at the time. Okay. So now I'm looking at the first pair, I'm looking at the second pair. And I look back, and I look back, and I look back, and why am I believing one over the other? That's a chiddush. Meaning, generally speaking, what do we say when witnesses are providing differing testimonies? We just simply throw it out. They cancel each other and we throw it out. And yet, in the parsha of Edom Zomimim, we believe the Edom Amazimim over the Edom Zomimim. And this is called a chiddush. Rava says, once the Torah is providing us a chiddush, we have to be conservative, lowercase c. We have to be conservative about that chiddush. We can't ein bo ela chidusho. The fact that we're believing the second set of witnesses, we really have to, the best of our ability, minimize that. What do I mean, minimize? We're not going to go backwards in time. The fact that we believe the second set of witnesses is already such a novel concept. So we're going to minimize it to the point where the Edom HaMazimim come into court, meaning from the first day of ER and onward. That's one argument that Rava provides. Rava provides a second argument. Ika de Amrei. Some have another version, Rava Namika Abai Svirle, Damar Lemafreu Nifsal. Really, fundamentally, Rava agrees with Abai. And as I pointed out, it's so intuitive, meaning it's hard to argue with Abai. And fundamentally, Rava really agrees with Abai. The Hacha Hainu Taima de Rava, and so if that's true, so then how can Rava disagree? We know Rava disagrees. Mishum Pseida de Lukuchos, he disagrees because the rest of the month of Nisan. Meaning, what's happened the rest of the month of Nisan? Commercial transaction, buying and selling. People have been going to court. And they keep using this witness again and again. And we didn't know he was bad. Discovery only came a month later. So you're basically going to have to do all those transactions that were done. And yet people buying. And really now it's going to upset the whole system if, after discovery, we're now going to have to go back and undo everything that was done previously. So basically, Rava says, as a rabbinic measure, we're basically going to push through all the transactions that were done, even though they were done based on the testimony of a Russia. So that's the so fundamentally, Rava agrees with Abaye, but just as a extrajudicial practice to help to help. Smooth over the whole judicial process, so they're going to push it through. Now the Gemara points out over here, my benayu. So now for Rava's position of we only give them the status of Rishayim from the point of discovery, not the point where they actually lied. So we gave two explanations. Explanation number one, chiddush. Explanation number two, really we should go back to the point of the actual testimony, the original testimony, but pseida de lukuchos. Okay, so there are two different reasons that are given. The Gemara points out, obviously, there are going to be distinctions based on these two reasons that are given. Number one, the Gemara says, "My beinayu da'asidu bei trei lechad v'trei lechad." Let's say it's not the case of Edom Zomimim, where two are testifying about two, and why should I listen to the second two over the first two? But rather, each witness of the original witnesses were disqualified by two Edom. There, it's not a chiddush. If two witnesses come and testify about a particular individual, that person lied, that's it. We believe two over one. So that's not a chiddush. That's just simply, he's established to be a liar. And so therefore, if your reason for Rav is chiddush, this is not a chiddush. We would go back to the point of actual testimony. If the reason behind Rav is pseudo de lukuchos, we would still allow all the cases in the month of Nisan to go through. Inami de paslina begaz lenusa. So the Gemara says, or let's say it's basically the same idea that the witnesses were incriminated not for lying in court, but just simply for being thieves themselves, meaning some other reason that would disqualify them from testifying, having nothing to do with being Edom Zomimim. So again, if the issue is Chiddush, this is not a Chiddush. If the issue is Pseda de Lekuchos, we still want all the transactions that took place in court to go through, and we will pass it through anyway. Lach lishon, the Gemara here spells it out. Lach lishon d'amra mishim chiddush leka. Lach lishon d'amra mishim pseda l'kuchas ika. Amra v'yirmei midifta avad rapapa uvde kavasi derava. Who do we follow like on this issue? So the Gemara points out that it was said over, not said over. Rapapa actually ruled like Rava, and Ravashi Amar Hilchasa Kavasi Da Abaye. Ravashi says Allah is like Abaye, and the Gemara concludes on this topic. Hilchasa Kavasi Da Abaye Biyal Kagan. Gemara here. Carbon copy of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the third parak. This is one of the Al-Kagam. There is a mnemonic, Yud Ayin Lamed, Kuf Gimel Mem, a mnemonic that helps us remember the six times Sirach Shas that we paskin like Abaye over that of Rava. The standard default position is that we paskin like Rava over Abaye, but here's one of the six examples of Eidos Lamafreya. That's the Ayin, where we paskin like Abaye, and we will go back to the point of the first day of Nisan, when they actually testified. Okay. The just as one last interesting note, the Gemara never actually spells out what all the six cases are of the Yal Kagam. So, and there is a debate amongst the Rishonim about one of the six. Anyway, that's okay. We'll stop over here. Tomorrow we'll pick it up at the Tudat.